Hello and welcome to The Unreleased, the design research podcast. This podcast exists to help map, broadcast and promote design research worldwide. The Unreleased podcast is brought to you by IAD, Universidade Europeia and UNIT.com. The interview was recorded at IAD as part of the PhD in Design program. To know more, visit unrelease.unitcom-yad.pt. That's unrelease.unitcom-yad.pt. In this episode, Professor Sarah Gansch talks with Rachel Cooper, Distinguished Professor of Design Management and Policy at Lancaster University and Director of Imagination Lancaster. Her research interests cover design thinking, design management, design policy, and across all sectors of industry, a specific interest in design for well-being and socially responsible design. During this interview, Cooper shares her view on how the healthcare system could benefit from design, design for policy, and how she has been looking into the issues of privacy, ethics, trust, risk, and security when we adopt new technologies.
So we're using design fiction to try and understand how people respond to these technologies, because too often we have technology-driven, led product development, consumer services, without understanding the behavioral adaptations that might occur.
Here are Sarah and Rachel.
Let's start this talk by how it all began. Since the first listeners are PhD students, can you talk a little bit about how your interest in design research started and what you expected at that time?
Okay, so I started my career a long time ago. I finished my undergraduate degree in 1976, and I was trained as a graphic designer, typographer, information designer. I went out into industry, I started doing freelance design work, and I suddenly realized that I didn't know enough both about design and about graphics, about typography, but mainly about the technology that was changing. In the late 70s, you probably don't remember, but in the late 70s, we were looking at word processing and computer-aided typesetting. And I thought, something's going to happen here. So I started my PhD on the role of information technology and new technology in the work of the designer, particularly the graphic designer. And I studied what was happening in the industry, in the printing industry, in the journalism industry, and looked at how they were using technology. But mainly, the big issue was there was nowhere doing PhDs in design. That I had to do it on my own. I had to get academics from other disciplines to help me. And I was the first woman in the UK to do a practice-based PhD in design. So I had to find a different type of examiner and the whole thing. And that's what made me interested in research. Because at the end of my PhD, I think about a month before my PhD viva, Apple bought their first computer out. So that was a change in the whole of the graphic design industry, and that's what I'd been looking at in my PhD. And I thought design research and practice-based design research can actually look for the future, can actually identify issues that we need to address. But there were not many designers, there were no designers doing research in education, and that's how I began. Following on from that PhD experience, I wanted to build the capacity of designers in industry and designers in academia to undertake research. But in order to do that, I had to understand how research was undertaken in other disciplines, because, of course, there was very little practice in doing research in design.
With the exponential growing on the importance of the design research awareness in companies, what kind of advice would you give to our students?
So I think the students now are coming into a world where companies might not necessarily understand design research and their role in the organization, but they certainly understand the role of design. So some of the bigger global companies, Google, Facebook, IBM, Microsoft, all understand the role of design, and so do the big consultancies. The big agencies around the world understand how to, that they need designers and have a lot of... McKinsey, for instance, have a whole group of designers. So certainly, a lot of the bigger global corporations understand the role of design and employ designers, particularly design researchers who've done PhDs, who've understand how they can do design and research and practice-based research. However, if you're in any country and you want to get a job that isn't in the big global companies, trying to get to companies that might be startups, there might be some understanding of design. But I would say the traditional SMEs, the small manufacturing companies, still struggle to understand how they can use design. So I think designers need to form groups and bodies and support groups to help them. Now, I understand in Portugal there is no body for design. There's no design council. There's no professional body. And I think the first thing I would do if I was in Portugal and I was a PhD student would form a focus group and a network to actually start to articulate the value of design to industry and get a power base behind myself.
Tell us about what projects are you currently working on.
So I am working on research that crosses the boundary between the digital and the physical space. So one project I'm working on at the moment is looking at how we address the issues of privacy, ethics, trust, risk and security when we adopt the Internet of Things, when we adopt AI at the edge and computing and all these technologies, robotics, machine learning. How are we going to adopt all these pervasive technologies and what that will do to our lives? So we're using design fiction to try and understand how people respond to these technologies. Because too often we have technology-driven, led product development, consumer services, without understanding the behavioural adaptations that might occur, whether it's crime, whether it's invasion of privacy, whether it's change in how children will learn. We need to understand and use design fiction, design speculation to engage multiple disciplines in the discourse about the future. And so that's one project we're working on.
And technology changing so much.
Very rapidly.
Policy needs to keep up with it.
And policy needs to keep up. So that's one area. The other area is looking at how design for policy. Mm-hmm. So we've done a lot of work on design and health, design of places and systems and services. But because technology is there and it's changing the way people behave, then government regulations on the adoption and use of these technologies in our lives needs to keep up with that. And I don't think governments actually understand how to think about the design of policy in this complex ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. How did you transition from design, you mentioned graphic design, you're a graphic designer, to the management of design?
Okay. So my history, as I said, you know, I did my undergraduate, I worked as a designer. And when you work in as a designer, you know how difficult it is for designers to convey to clients what they're doing and how they charge for it, to convey to clients the role of design in their organisation. So the reason I moved into design management in the first instance was in the UK in the 80s, everybody was promoting design and innovation. Design innovation will help globally, it will help manufacturing, it will help everything. And the government put money into design for the first time. In fact, Mrs. Thatcher had a summit in 1982 with all the top designers like Conran and to talk about the value of design. And she realized that designers didn't understand enough about business. Business didn't understand enough about design. And I was lucky to get funding to teach business to designers, design to business people, and design to industry. So I developed and ran a number of programs translating the knowledge for those different audiences. And actually, that's how I came to write the book, The Design Agenda, in 1995, which basically summed all those sort of theories that I developed up.
What area would you like to work that you haven't already?
I think there are so many challenges in the world at the moment. So we've got to really look at all the complex issues around climate change. So there's a whole area there that we need to look at. What is the role of the designer in the circular economy? I don't know enough about that, but I'd like to get a whole team of people around me who can work on that, and that's what I'm doing now. And the other area is that everybody is predicting that the health and well-being of society and the development of the of health services is going to be more and more stretched. And in the UK, we have a national health system, mm-hmm. and it is underfunded.
Yeah. And it's getting several cuts from the government
yes,
as well.
Yeah, that, exactly. Yeah. But the answer for most governments is, if they want to get in, win elections, is to put lots of money into it. And actually, I think we need to do more on designing the service to rethink what healthcare is about. So fundamentally look at what's driving the technology of development, but also looking at the systems and services and the behaviours. Because exponentially, we're growing the technology, we're growing the demand, we haven't got the funds and the people to deliver it. So how do we rethink the system of design, which means rethinking design of policy, rethinking the services, and then looking at the technology. So that's a big project I'd like to work on if I had the time.
Yeah. So what was it like to build a research centre from scratch? What was your funding idea for it?
So this is a fun story. So I was recruited to Lancaster University to head up the Lancaster Institute of Contemporary Arts, which was music, theatre, art. There was no design. So the rector or the VC asked me why, I asked him, why would I want to come to that university? And he said, what would you do with £3 million? This is in 2006. So I said, I would like to build a new type of design research lab. And he gave me £3 million. I was very lucky. He gave me £3 million and I recruited 9 people. And these 9 people were not, it was not product designers or graphic designers. It was a mix. It was some social scientists, some computer scientists, some urban designers, graphic designers, product designers. And the whole idea was I had to, it was rather like an entrepreneurial lab in a university because I had to make it sustainable in 5 years. And the model was very different to what you'd expect. Normally, if you're building a department in a university, you would first build your undergraduate courses and get the funding back from teaching undergraduates. What we did was say, we're going to get funding through research, funding through PhDs, and one of the first PhDs. And then we would develop a master's course, and then we develop undergraduate course. So it's sort of reverse pyramid. So it was all about research informing undergraduate. It was trickle down rather than push up. And so we developed a very interdisciplinary research group, but also we were very agile in getting funding. We taught ourselves to write research bids that would address the current political industry zeitgeist of what the challenges were. So we were always looking externally. It wasn't saying, I'm interested in this research, I want to do this. It was, where are the challenges? We will learn and we will build research groups to address those challenges.
So what skills and qualities were you looking for the people that you hired for the centre initially, the 9 people you mentioned?
Flexible, plastic minds that did not come with preconceived ideas about what design research was about and where it would operate. So people who could listen and hear what other disciplines, other challenges in industry, in communities, in politics, and then understand how they, through design research, could address those challenges. So it's very unhappy people. So we have a motto: respect, responsibility, learning, and joy. You must respect other people's talents. You give people responsibility to build their own career, and you help them and support them. But mainly we have to learn from each other, and it always has to be fun.
It really is a multidisciplinary group.
Absolutely.
Also different experts in different areas coming together to work on something. Yeah.
But that is hard.
Yeah.
Very hard bringing different, because you have to listen to other people.
Yeah.
And some people don't want to listen to other people. But designers, I think, should be able to listen to other people, because design, in a way, is what I'd call a socio-technical bridge. In design, we try to understand the human world, the social world, we try to understand the technological world, and we synthesize the knowledge to create the material and the immaterial world.
So what have you learned that you wish you knew 10 years ago?
What I've learned is the main thing, if you're leading research groups, is learning people, learning about people's relationships with each other, learning about how you mentor people, how you encourage people. And what I also wish is that there were more people who could lead design and lead design thinking. We need more people who have the confidence to go out in the world to deliver design research in a confident way.
Looking towards the future, what does innovation in design as a concept mean to you?
Uh-huh. Well, design and innovation are a frequently used combination, and you have to be very careful about this. Roberto Verganti and I have discussed this quite a lot, and there is somebody else who works in this area. You have to be careful. Everybody uses the word innovation. We need innovation. We need innovation everywhere. Let's bring in design. You know, innovation can occur without design, so we have to be really careful about what design brings. And I've done some research in this area, and I'm writing some papers at the moment. And I wrote a paper called Design, the Language of Innovation. And this is where we studied actually all the papers we could find in the design literature which mentioned innovation. And we identified where the key themes were. And one of the key themes is the ability of design to visualize, to make the intangible tangible, and therefore enable innovation. Lots of people can have ideas, but what design often does is make that innovation, make it tangible,
make people
understand it. Whether it's a two-dimensional drawing or a three-dimensional object or just a prototype, often in all the papers we looked at, it was this role of design to be this socio-technical bridge between all the different thought leaders, but actually to make it
the
tangible.
The visual part of it. So it's kind of like design thinking tools to make it visual.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's all about the visual part of it. So you mentioned climate change before. I mentioned you wanted to work with the climate change. So what kind of social modules would you suggest to address it?
Well, I think we have to look at, in one sense, we have to look at all the technologies that can help social change. So, you know, whether it's renewables but we also have to look at radically nudging behaviours and how design can, so there's a whole theory of nudge, how you can design something that will change people's behaviours so that they recycle more, you know, so that they wear the same clothes. But in that instance, I think we then have to start looking at design in the economic system, because somebody asked me this morning in the conference, what can you do in this area? And we may need to rethink some of the economic models of consumption, production and consumption, because companies manufacture, to drive the economy.
Yes.
You know, GDP is all about productivity. But actually, in the future, we may need to think about new economic models. So we may need to work with economists to design new economic models, and then to look at the systems, the ecosystems of creativity, production, making, and consuming in a different way. And that would really need for designers to work with economists.
It really needs to be a circular way.
The circular economy and all that.
And even if companies start using...
Yeah, and remaking and repairing. But if you talk to... So you've got the economists on one side, and then you what I call the environmental scientists on another. And, you know, we still have issues around electric vehicles, you know, the batteries, the manufacture of the batteries. So people's understanding of the whole environmental issues, the climate, and its response to climate change, and then the economic. There's a whole system there that I don't yet think designers are in the centre of, or even around, and we need much more intellectual capacity looking at that. But I believe that design, through visualisation, through making, through visualising ecosystems by challenging behaviours and how people behave, and producing what I call design fictions, films, artifacts to engage the public. So there's a whole plethora of tools that design research can use to engage that mm-hmm. those challenges.
So what future do you foresee for a possible balance between developed and developing countries, and how can design intervene in this direction?
I think design already is working in developing countries and working with what I call the basic technologies. You know, years ago we all read in the 70s the Victor Papamax book on this, and I think that's still valid, finding alternative technologies that are used in developing countries, but also developing countries, as they did with the mobile phone, jumped technologies. So I think we can do that. But, I'm doing work, my team are doing work in Ghana mm-hmm. on antimicrobial resistance. So, you know, we're looking at simple things like how people clean their homes, how we can help people understand about bacteria and about viruses. And so there are fundamental ways that we can help as designers, and we can translate that knowledge with other academics in institutions in the developing world. So I think there's...
You think it's access to information?
It's access to information. It's joint collaborative work. Mm-hmm. It's not just thinking that we in the global north, in the developed countries, can go and impose.
Okay.
It's much more co-production. And understanding the way we work, particularly in design, because, of course, in some areas of design, we've done a lot more. We're much more sort of mature. But if you go to Design Indaba in South Africa, mm-hmm. they're doing some really interesting projects. So I never think we should be colonial in that sense. We have to, you know, Portugal and England were very colonial countries. And so, you know, we shouldn't just think we can, you know, do the same that we did.
We can also learn from them.
We can learn a lot. Absolutely.
They're certainly
I think it's more about collaborative design research than it is, mm-hmm. you know, imposing a global north perspective on a global south.
That's true. So has the public's perspective on design and its importance changed, do you think?
I'm not sure. I think the problem is we in the 90s and 2000s we had an over promotion of the designerly this and the designerly that. So I think there is still a level of education for the public. And if you ask most parents of students, the parents think they're coming here to learn a trade. Mm. And rather than being educated. Mm-hmm. And I think we still need to illustrate to the public that design is a rigorous design area that can contribute to the world in the sense of more general.
And some companies also think that design thinking is the solution to everything, that's a model that can be applied in multiple ways.
So
there
is also an issue about everybody thinks design can be done by everybody because design thinking has ruined the world. And and so all management schools think they can think about design thinking. You know, so we have to be careful about that. Because design is a tacit knowledge that you get trained in, You learn. It's about seeing. It's about interpreting. It's about building a skill base. And even though, we popularize design, it is still a skill base, mm-hmm. and it still brings something to other disciplines. And we really do need to illustrate the rigor and the science behind design.
Can design really help build a better world?
Yes, design can help build a better world, but it mustn't be oversold, and it must be rigorous. Mm-hmm. So there's some really good design research being done, and we have to make sure that it carries on being rigorous, and that people see that the value of it and the impact, and we mustn't oversell it. We mustn't oversell the idea that design can solve everything. Design can't solve everything, but design as part of a bigger team can get there quicker. The implementation quicker.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Rachel.
That's fine. Nice to be here.
If you like what you heard today, please subscribe to our podcast on the main platform. For more information about the Unreleased podcast, go to unreleased.unitcom-yad.pt. There you can find all the episodes and more information about our guests. Unreleased podcast is the result of the work of the students of Design Cultures and Practices course from the PhD in Design program of Yad Universidade Europeia. It's produced and edited by Unitcom.